Hello and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. Every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Today, we're going to explore the health of the arts in America, specifically theater. To help me in that venture, I've invited Brian Willis, who is currently playwright in residence for the Northwest Playwrights Alliance at Seattle Repertory Theater, senior editor of North Northwest for the Northwest Playwrights Association, artistic director for Play Buffet Summer Theater Program, and soon to be a panelist on the Idaho Commission for the Arts. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
It's so great to have you. We've had a couple of other opportunities to work together and play together, and it's just a delight to be able to talk with you. But you are clearly an overachiever. Having written and or
I've been called worse.
You've written and or produced literally dozens of plays. So tell us what it's like to make a living as a playwright in this country.
Oh, I think you have to be a little obsessed. Theater is full of people who have problems in other areas. It's essentially something kind of has to be wrong with you. And that's what I love about theater. If you're a buttons and knobs person, you can be run the soundboard. Or if you're a control freak, you can be a stage manager. If you really want to soak up the attention, acting, and I don't know what it is for playwriting, but a lot of us find our homes in theater. So it's not really a choice. As with some professions, we say you have the bug. So it's what you do, and you're going to do it whether you're making a living at it or not. So it's just a way of seeing the world. And that part is really addictive, because I love the way that playwriting helps me see and listen to the world. And those times when what you've written is that you're in the hands of a good director and good actors and designers, and it all works, and then you plug in the audience to complete that picture. There are times when it's so miserable, you think if you concentrate on the floor enough, it will open up and everyone will fall in and the misery will be over. But when it works, it's fantastic, and there's really nothing quite like it. So in a way, it's not really a choice. It truly is a way of life that I enjoy very much. I've been writing plays for 40 years. And
wow.
I probably started making a living at it in 1992. And I've been very, very fortunate and diligent in following that pursuit. And it's been a joyous, wildly unpredictable ride. I just never know quite where it's going to take me. And most often those places are places I'm grateful to be, like Vashon Island.
You've done some work with us and with some folks here on Vashon Island. I want to talk to you about that later, but I'm curious about your process as a playwright. You said it's a way of life. What have been the topics of your plays, if there's any a strain of commonality among them or not, and what sparks your need to write a play?
Ooh, those are big questions. that's probably the source for a very long, boring play. Why Brian writes plays. And I may not be the best qualified to say that, but first and foremost, I just enjoy it. You know, the word play is in playwright, and it's just fun. And I like the way it keeps, that it keeps challenging me artistically and my imagination and in studying various topics. I really enjoy that. I think a lot of success in life comes from adapting and learning. I think that's true in parenting and in government and politics and in romance, and certainly in playwriting. So I look for a different type of challenge with each script. And I don't keep track of how many scripts I've written, but you know, in 40 years, it's that's quite a few. So I look for something that is different for me, that offers me a different artistic challenge each time. That could be a libretto for an opera or a radio play or a children's play or a political play of some sort. So it's really that challenge. In terms of themes, I find that I often write about the human connection or lack of connection to the natural world and where we find solace in the natural world, which is, of course, that's I've stolen that from every origin story in the history of the world, including the Bible and Superman. And, you know, we traditionally go to the natural world to find tranquility and just a little breathing room to think. And that is, that's Batman in the Batcave and Superman in the Fortress of Solitude. That's, you know, Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha. That's a very old story. And I see in our lifetimes that the world population has more than doubled. And here in the Northwest, those places to go have been diminishing. And I think it's very important to not lose that. I mean, so I'm on the cusp of an ecological lecture, and I try not to write political pieces per se, but to have issues bubble up. And I find that those are some common themes. Also, I'm a farm boy. I grew up on a Shetland pony farm, and Shetland pony farm. My dad, you know, he was a beloved. He was a great man. I really love my dad, and I miss him all the time. But he was not a very good businessman. It took him a long time to accept that one of his sons wanted to be a playwright. And one day I turned to him and he said, he was giving me a hard time about being a playwright. And I said, "And I'm sorry, what is it that you do? It starts with a P." "Yeah, a pony farmer." Another brilliant career choice, Dad. But he was a pony farmer for the same reason I'm a playwright, for the love of it and the challenge of it.
That would be a challenge. Yeah, what I know of Shetland.
He got it. It took him a while, but he got it.
What I know of Shetland ponies comes from my childhood's around horses, a lot of horses, and the ponies were the nasty ones.
They have that reputation because they're a little smarter than a horse. And it's funny, if you put a pony in with a mule, a Percheron, thoroughbreds, and you stick out a carrot, I've done this. The pony will be like Mo of the Three Stooges. Spread out. You'll see a Clydesdale shake with fear as the pony takes the carrot, because they're fast and they're smart and they're closer to the underbelly of a horse. But I have to tell you, I grew up around at least 40 ponies, and it was like having a bunch of big dogs out there. I was never bitten or bucked or kicked or anything. So it was a really wonderful place to grow up. Of course, by the time you're 11 years old, but when you try to ride a pony, it's sort of like driving an old Yugo. It's a little bumpy, but they're wonderful with carts because they're very, very strong, and they pound for pound they can pull more than any horse, and they're fast. So it was a really great place to grow up. It was near Olympia. It was a 50 acre farm in a valley. And
oh, that really does sound like an ideal childhood.
In a lot of ways, it was.
And I imagine it gave you a lot of time to imagine stories, to be a storyteller. And when you talk about ecological issues, you are speaking to my heart. I am an environmental fanatic. So yeah. I'm wondering if you ever have, or if you plan to, or if you think it's possible to use theater to begin to help people work towards saving the planet.
Well, that sounds very lofty, but I think it's a real key. And I have devoted quite a bit of my career to trying to do that. And sometimes more overtly than other times. In 1994, I worked with Harlequin Productions in Olympia. And we raised about $60,000, and we created this kids' musical called The Incredible Undersea Trial of Joseph P. Lonboy. And it was all about watershed education. And so we wrote this play, which was a lot of fun. It was about a high school kid who actually couldn't pass high school. He was 31 years old, but he was still in high school because he couldn't pass algebra because he loved fish so much. Every day he would go fishing, and one day the fish pulls him in. He has an underwater breathing apparatus because he was going to go down and get that fish. He gets trapped. He gets his foot stuck in a shopping cart, and he can't get up, so he needs the help of the undersea world, the underriver world, to save him, and they put him on trial. So in the 50-minute play, the audience has to decide whether or not Joe gets to go back up or not. And they didn't always vote the same way.
Sometimes they killed him off?
Well, I never killed him, but sometimes people thought he shouldn't go back up. So it was a play for students, but I really found the best audience for it was a family audience of all ages. You know, it's tough if you put a 13-year-old in with some 8-year-olds, and they see the 8-year-olds enjoying it, then they don't. But if you see your grandma there enjoying it and your whole family, then it's okay. And that play was done, gosh, Harlequin did 100 performances of it. Seattle Public Theater toured it for 8 years. It's been done, that play's probably been done over the years by more companies, and I haven't kept track of, it's grossed at least $1 million, and it's been done everywhere. It's a very, very successful play for me. And it had a real, a very heartfelt message to it as well, though it was steeped in humor. And I was especially gratified because those kids, and actually, you know, we're talking, it opened in 1994, has been produced for a couple of years, but it's, those kids are now still on the planet, and it's really gratifying to me to reach a younger audience, because let's face it, they're going to be here longer than us, and the potential for them to change their behavior is profoundly meaningful. So it does sound pie in the sky, but I think that's very important work. And though not all my plays are dedicated to watershed education, that was a really fun one. Bruce Whitney did the music, Scott Whitney did the lyrics, and we had so much fun. And
it was a musical. And so was Joe the avatar for the average polluting human?
Yes, he was a lawn boy. He was a lawn boy. And when you start, which doesn't sound like much, but when you think about how much Americans, how much time and damage we do just keeping our lawns mm-hmm. pretty and green, because, you know, we have so little Western heritage of our own, we have to try to be England or whatever.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect.
So yes, he didn't really think about the damage he was doing with his fertilizer and moss killer and how, where that water goes and how it affects the natural world, and ultimately how it affects himself and the people he loves.
You know, I'm working with an organization here called the Whole Vashon Project, and we are all about standing up to climate crisis with art. And I would love to do that play here. So I'll talk to you about that later. But
okay, well, we have Charlotte there.
We have Charlotte, so right.
Charlotte is an incredible director, and I find that Charlotte is so community-minded. And when I say the community, her community is the world. A couple of years ago, Charlotte took one of my plays, and myself and my son, we ran light boards. We went to China for a play. She's done so much international work, and we're working on a project right now that we hope to take to Japan in 2 years. Charlotte is a very, not only talented, but quite an extraordinary artist. I'm not sure if people realize that on Vashon. I have a feeling I know many of them do. I really love working with Charlotte, and you've got so much talent. Gosh, Dara and Mick, you have a lot.
Well, and in fact, we just had a, a great showcase of all that talent this past weekend, and Charlotte directed Savage Love. This is you're listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. The show is Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here talking with playwright and many other things, Brian Willis. And Brian mentioned Charlotte. She is Charlotte Tinkin, a Vashon Island director and founder now of the Vashon Repertory Theater, of which Brian has been a part. And Brian, you're getting ready to work with Charlotte on taking a play to Japan. Tell us, can you tell us about that?
I can, yeah. I'm very excited about it. It's a play I've been researching for a couple of years, actually, which isn't unusual for me to percolate on an idea for a long time. My wife Margo and I were up at Nia Bay visiting the macaw. They have a wonderful little museum. If your listeners haven't been there before, there's quite an extraordinary museum there, the Macaw Museum. And I happened upon this exhibit that showed it was a Japanese fishing boat that the rudder broke on this boat. There were 15 men aboard, and three of them were 14 years old at the time. The rudder broke, and the boat drifted for 5,000 miles. This was in the 1830s. It drifted for 5,000 miles, and it took quite a while for that to happen. By the time it hit the shores near Nia Bay, only three of the fishermen were still alive. And by this time, the three were 15 years old. Those were the first people from Japan to be in what is now the United States. So they were taken in by the tribe, had them for about a year, and then they worked sort of a trade with the Hudson's Bay Company, and when I say trade, I think that these three boys were they did a lot of hard labor there with the macaw tribe.
Wow.
And they were taken to London then, and they were the first Japanese citizens in England. And then an American captain tried to take them back to Japan. But if we recall, before Commodore Perry and the whole opening of Japan to the West, if you lived in Japan, you couldn't leave. And if you did leave, you couldn't come back. So Ooh. As the American ship was going, trying to deliver these three 15-year-olds, they were fired upon and they turned around, and those 15-year-olds never did make it back to Japan. It's an extraordinary tale, and one that I think few of us know about. So I have enlisted the help of one of my producers and collaborators from Japan, actually a couple people, Chia Yuhara and Chikako Matsumoto. And I'm also working with another actor that I've known since the early 90s, who's quite extraordinary, and that's Cecil Chica, who is a macaw and squawkson, and it's been, he's helped me on a lot of projects. So the three of us are working together to tell this story from this point of the macaw nation, the American side, the Japanese side, and we'll work with the British side as well.
What an incredible story.
It is quite a story. So we want to do it here in Olympia, and also probably up at the museum. And Charlotte is directing. So I really like it when I can bring in a director early on in the creative process. And after that's done, we're working on funding to take the project to Japan as well. This is going to be, this type of thing has to be, even without COVID, it has to be planned quite a bit in advance.
Well, that's a big question. The first question that comes to my mind is, how are you going to pull this off in the days of COVID? And in a broader perspective, what do you see now as the health of theater under COVID and post-COVID?
Well, that's a big question. And to answer your first question, we've scheduled it for May of 2022. So we're hoping that by that time, surely, we've actually postponed it because of that.
Yeah.
So we're hoping by May of 2022 that we'll be able to do this safely. And of course, as you know, when we produced those radio shows on Vashon Island in October, that staying safe was very important. So working around those precautions have been very difficult, even working in radio. Well, to answer your second question, theater has been declared dead many, many times over the centuries. And I know some people think that's going to happen again. We'll be back. We'll be back. This is not the first time this has happened. When young William Shakespeare went from Stratford to London, theater had been shut down many times because of various plagues. There's a particularly brutal one that lasted for 2 years during Shakespeare's early career in London. They just didn't do theater. When they did do theater, it was around the banks. It was on the outer limits of the city, which is why the Globe was on the other side of the Thames. So not only were you a complete reprobate if you were a theater person, you know, you're Molière, you've got to change your name because you can't be buried in the church with normal people. Theater people were freaks even back then. So they just kind of kept at it, and there were enough people that were lifers. It's going to take more than a freaking plague to beat me. And what am I going to do? Stop writing plays? I'm just going to stockpile my work. Actually, I'm like a lot of people, I'm finding different ways to in different mediums to disseminate my work.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. I do think there's been some innovation in theater, and I know we've experienced some of it here. Talk about it in more general terms, if you will. What kind of innovation have you seen among theatrical folks during the plague?
In my lifetime, I've never seen theater shut down from, the biggest Broadway shows to the smallest salons. I mean, really, from top to bottom, we've been absolutely slayed. So it's no joke, and I do not want to diminish the fact that this is a brutal time for theater, the whole profession. And I know that a lot of theaters just aren't going to come back. You can imagine closing any business for that long, and it's not as if most theaters are overstocked with money to begin with. So the idea of having to pay insurance and venue costs and rental and your people and all that, it's absolutely devastating. So it is tough, and it's going to be a while to come back. I marvel that the first things to come back are always around the United States seem to be bowling alleys, tattoo parlors, nail salons, So I can see where most, which makes sense. That's where most Americans have their priorities. That theater falls way behind bowling alleys, tattoo parlors. We have 32 tattoo parlors in and around Olympia.
Are you kidding? Wow.
A couple theaters. So, God bless the tattooers and people who love tattoos. That's a priority in my hometown. So they're having a tough time too, of course. I'm just saying that theater is, it's been particularly brutal as different times people have been going to movies and those are going to open up. I think theater will be one of the last professions to open up again. So it's a slog. It is definitely a marathon, and it always is. But now we're having to do it in a full body cast. Will it come back? Yes, of course it will come back. It will be different because places like the Washington State University, the University of Alaska at Anchorage, and the Evergreen State College, before COVID, closed their theater program.
Oh, they did?
They did. And that's happening around the country. It's a brutal time for small colleges in particular, and theater programs are closing around the country at major universities.
Even before COVID, what's the impetus for that?
Well, it's about money. So if you look at Evergreen's really hurting with enrollment, and they see that, one of the one of the, to me, a very important part of the lifeblood of the Evergreen State College has been communications and the theater program. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've worked with so many people from Evergreen. I don't mean to pick on Evergreen. That's where I met Charlotte. Actually, right. I was booking the lawn boy, the incredible undersea trial of Joseph B. Lawnboy. That's where I met Charlotte in 1994. So, you know, Charlotte's job doesn't exist any longer at Evergreen. That's profoundly sad. So this is an ongoing fight.
Is that about rising tuition costs? Sorry, we have a bit of a delay here.
You know, there are a lot of reasons why Evergreen's falling off, and not all colleges are, but we have seen around the country several small colleges are, and part of this population, and part of that is that, you know, if you go to, I went to Oberlin College. I'm an Olympia kid. I went to Oberlin College, and if I went to Oberlin College now online, it would be about $70,000 a year.
Yikes.
So part of that is, that's a lot of money.
That's outrageous.
A typical cost. It is. I was able to get through college by working in a salmon cannery, and I was very lucky to be able to do that. But I think for a college student to make it, to pay tuition with a summer job, I think you'd pretty much have to sell crack cocaine to make $70,000 during the summer.
Yeah.
So
part
of its economics.
Yeah.
You know, our culture, and I'm putting Vash on aside here because and I've found this on many of the islands in San Juan too, that the, you know, you go to a place like Orcas or Vashon, not the Vashon's, one of the San Juans. I hope I'm not geographically disturbing anyone here, but they're really great theaters that the community has put together, that these communities value arts. Part of the reason Vashon is so cool is that that community values not just theater, but painting and poetry. It's such a vital part of what makes that a great place to live. Oh my gosh.
It is. And I appreciate you saying that.
At the high school there, you have a better venue than Stephen there. I think Stephen may be, I'm not sure if he's retired yet, but Stephen Floyd. But what a great program and what a wonderful facility there, because people value the arts on Vashon.
We do, and yet it's hard to finance theater here, and certainly even here the people who work in theater are doing it as a side job. They're not making a living.
Tough. Yeah, it's tough, and unfortunately Washington State is always ranks near the bottom in terms of funding for the arts, curiously enough. And the United States ranks near the bottom in the industrialized world for funding for the arts. So it's always brutal. It is always brutal. And I try to find ways to be as creative with disseminating my work as I am with my work. And that's really kind of what it takes in order to survive.
That's kind of the business of it. Yeah. We're talking with playwright Brian Willis, and we're just about out of time, Brian. I knew this was going to happen. So I have one last question, and you've got 2 minutes, maybe a minute and a half to answer it. And that is, of the innovations that have come out of COVID in theater, do you think any of them, which of them do you think might stick?
Oh, we hate rehearsing on Zoom. It's really, really tough. And a lot of theaters are trying to find ways to make money off of streaming. That's really tough.
Yeah.
I hope some type of resurgence from long ago, and radio would be possible. There's a big question of what that's really going to look like and who's going to survive. But we will survive, and we will be back. And I really admire my colleagues who are finding ways to continue to create and share work. I'm not sure what that's going to look like after this, but I do know that we will carry on.
Thank you, Brian Willis. Yeah, humans have to continue telling stories.
Yes.
Thank you, Brian Willis, for joining me here on Real Talk. And thank you, folks, for listening. We're here every Tuesday at noon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, and voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you.